Hi everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of Bald, a Bouldering podcast. Today's episode will be different from previous ones. Instead of covering a subject regarding training for bouldering, I will be covering the life of a legend, John Gill, the Master of Rock. The man who personally introduced bouldering in the United States. Now, while doing my research and writing the script, I noticed that it would be extremely difficult to cover the whole of John's life. He simply achieved too much to cover in a 20-minute episode. So I planned to cover certain aspects of his life, focusing on his big achievements and innovations in bouldering. First of all, we'll take a short dive in his personal history, and after that, I'll cover his ascent of the thimble, the climb that started the legend. I'll follow that up with a shorter part on Gill's amazing physical feats, to then proceed to our main attraction, an insight into Gill's bouldering style and philosophy. Now, I hope you're comfortable by now, so let's get on with it. Part 1. Personal History. John Gill was born the 16th of February, 1937, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. His father, John Paul Gill, was the first person in his family to get a degree. Before that, he used to take care of the horses that pulled minecarts, so he surely did achieve the American dream, working his way up to a job as a mathematician at the University of Alabama. His mother, Bernice Elman Gill, attended a class by John Paul, and just as 1 and 1 equals 2, they soon became a couple. As usual for the time, marriage wasn't too far off, followed up by the arrival of a child. John Gill, during his childhood, spent a lot of time in nature and on university campuses. His father continued to teach mathematics throughout his life, and Gill would often accompany him on these campuses. It is possible that his first contact with climbing didn't happen in nature, but actually on the campus of Texas University, where he was often seen climbing on the structures and buildings at only 12 years old. At age 17, in 1953, Gill started climbing properly. He visited the Beehive Cliffs in North Georgia with friends and recalls the primordial appeal of climbing on steep rock stimulated by exposure. And during that time, he also climbed the Maiden in the Flatirons, along with its 120-foot or 36-meter breathtaking rappel. In 1954, Gill started college at Georgia Tech. Along with his fellow students, he had to take 3 physical education courses, track, swimming, and gymnastics. Now, he showed modest talent for track. He was a good sprinter, but could not keep pace. And for the swimming course, students were required to be drown-proof. This meant that they had to survive while jumping in the deep end of the pool with hands and feet bound. I think this possibly contributed to Gill's fearlessness. Gill did excel at gymnastics. He showed talent for all disciplines, but mostly for rope climbing. He could climb a 20-foot or 6-meter rope in 3.4 seconds, using only his arms. Now, the world record at the time, 2.8 seconds, just 0.6 seconds off. Now, during his time at Georgia Tech, Gill went climbing in the Cloudland Canyon a lot. One time, he actually discovered the equipment of moonshiners in the woods surrounding the crag. He would also share nightly bouldering sessions with friends on campus. The first time Gill ever used gymnastic chalk for better friction was possibly on these college buildings. And this, coincidentally, was the first time anyone ever used gymnastic chalk for climbing. An innovation that would slowly pick up popularity due to Gill's fame. In 1956, he enrolled at the University of Georgia, graduating in 1958 with a degree in mathematics, following nicely in his father's footsteps. Now, he quickly signed up for the U.S. Air Force and attended a special graduate meteorology program at the University of Chicago, after which he was assigned to Glasgow Air Force Base in 1959. He mostly worked as a weather forecaster, spending his free time climbing, bouldering, and achieving physical feats. Part 2. The Ascent of the Thimble. In the late 50s and early 60s, during his time at Glasgow Air Force Base, Gill spent a lot of time climbing in the Needles. He discovered his love for free soloing and did multiple solo ascents such as Spire 1, Spire 2, The Wicked Picket, and many more. He had this to say about the experience. Difficulty ranged from 5.2 to 5.12, and I enjoyed the easier climbs every bit as much as the harder ones. Sometimes I took a rope along and self-belayed, and other times I free soloed, only taking a rappel rope. At a thimble, an impressive 30-foot or 9-meter pinnacle on the parking lot of the Needles grabbed Gill's attention as a possible challenge. He had already climbed one route to the top, following a groove that went up the spire. Using this route, he inspected a possibly harder way to ascend the pinnacle. It looked possible to him, so he started training for this route. Gill would train his raw power in the gym at Glasgow Air Force Base. To prepare for this particular route, he started squeezing the nuts and bolts sticking out the walls at the gym. And this way, he got used to the sensation of holding the little nubbins that he'd have to hold on the thimble. At this time, Gill was able to do 7 consecutive regular one-arm pull-ups, 3 fingertip one-arm pull-ups, and 1 one-finger pull-up. Now, with this amount of strength, Gill felt comfortable attempting the climb several times, choosing to first practice the lower part and jumping off in the middle section. A friend of him said that Gill, quote, jumped off from about 20 foot or 6 meters and landed like a cat in the midst of jagged talus boulders. Now, he never practiced the route on top rope and didn't use a crash pad since those weren't around at the time. There also was a huge risk of falling on the parking lot guardrail down below, and the only security he did have was a possible escape to the other route on the thimble he had already climbed. In the spring of 1961, Gill felt ready to top this pinnacle. He started up the route confidently and without much fuss, topped out. At his free solo in the Black Hills of South Dakota was the first 5.12, or 7A at the time. Gill had the following to say. You not only get psyched up, but almost become hypnotized or mesmerized, to the point where your mind goes blank and you climb by well-cultivated instincts. You do it. He also noted that when reaching the top, he felt a peculiar absence of feeling. He never bragged about completing this climb. Nevertheless, did word spread about his daring ascent. John Gill wasn't just another strong climber anymore, but a legend who was set to wrestle his way up impossible-to-climb boulders, defying gravity and breaking through the limits of the time. A couple years later, in 1964, Royal Robbins tried to repeat the thimble and failed. He was impressed by Gill's style of the ascent, since he never top-roped it to practice beforehand. In the words of Robbins, hats off to John Gill. Part 3. Physical feats. Now, over the years, Gill performed many physical feats alongside his bouldering and free soloing. I'll list a few of them to hopefully motivate you into getting stronger and maybe also getting more creative with how to get stronger. Gill weighed 190 pounds, or 86 kilos, and was 6'2", or 187 centimeters tall. Yet he was still able to perform a one-finger, one-arm pull-up. He started practicing this when a friend told him about a German climber who could allegedly perform this feat. This, of course, was just a myth, and Gil became the first to be able to pull it off. He could do one with his right index finger and with his left middle finger. He also excelled in normal one-arm pull-ups on a bar, being able to do 7 reps. And later in life, he was able to do a one-arm pull-up while holding his 30-pound or 13-kilogram daughter. Strongest dad of the 60s? Now, on some days, he would also be seen frisbee-throwing garbage can lids with perfect form and performing no-hand roots on slabby boulders, showing off his impressive footwork and creative problem-solving. If you passed by Jenny Lake Ranger Station in 1960, there's a chance you'd have seen a pair of legs floating horizontally with pointed toes out of the door. Gil loved to practice fingertip front levers on door jams and became notoriously good at them. So good that he basically invented the one-arm front lever. A physical feat so impressive that many professional climbers today are not able to pull it off. Now, I highly recommend Googling the picture of Gil performing this one-arm front lever and trying it for yourself. The sheer impossibility of this exercise is stunning. Part 4. Gil's bouldering style and philosophy. Now, back in the 50s and 60s, bouldering was a completely new phenomenon, unknown to most. And for those who did practice it, it served as practice for real climbing. Bouldering routes didn't have intrinsic importance, and glorious summits of huge peaks was the only thing that seemed to matter. Boulders were stunts, not artistry. Gil was the first climber to see the value of bouldering and the freedom it offered. Unrestricted by equipment, the boulderer could pursue pure difficulty of movement with a focus on graceful technique and explosive strength. In 1969, John Gil wrote his first article for American Alpine Journal, titled The Art of Bouldering. In this article, he addressed the disdain for bouldering at the time, convincing climbers to try it out and enraging some old-fashioned alpinists. He described the boulderer in the following way. The boulderer is concerned with form almost as much as success and will not feel that he has truly mastered a problem until he can do it gracefully. And other dynamic moves associated with bouldering were a big part of the disdain for the sport. Climbing should be static and controlled, thought many. But Gil thought that these flying moves, lunges, and swinging leaps were not execrable mutations of good technique. These methods could be disciplined and executed artistically. And Gil was able to introduce this dynamic style because of his education and background in gymnastics. In this article, Gil also shared some skills for the serious boulderer. The following made his list: one-arm pull-ups, one-finger pull-ups, one-arm mantel presses, one-arm fingertip chin-ups on a door jam. Now, I consider myself a serious boulderer, but I'm not yet capable of performing any of these feats except for one-arm pull-up. Time to get in shape. Gil kept his own bouldering endeavors, mostly to himself. He preferred to boulder on his own, deep in the forest, keeping his ascents private and leaving white chalk marks where he had climbed. This contributed to the legend of John Gil, a bouldering master who topped ridiculously hard, short and steep boulders. Now, Gil was aware of his legendary status and once had an interesting encounter with a female hiker. I was once bouldering in solitude in the Needles when a young female climber walked up and introduced herself and asked who I was. I told her and continued bouldering. She turned and walked away, and after a few minutes saying over her shoulder, "You can't be John Gil, he climbs much better than that." An amazing thing to note is that Gil used the boulder in leather hiking boots, since climbing shoes hadn't yet made their way to the US, which added to the sheer impossibility of his climbs, which were often unable to be repeated for a while after. I'd now like to include some extracts from a fireside chat between Pat Amond and John Gill. The following are thoughts on nature, bouldering, and more. I firmly believe that most people who wish to pursue bouldering can really benefit from formal gymnastics. Rope climbing, steel rings, parallel bars, some high bar, free exercise, etc. I've personally never used weights for training except to do a one-arm pull-up with 20 to 30 pounds in the other hand. And what's worked best for me has been a combination of actual bouldering and certain forms of gymnastics. And the weakest link between the climber and the rock is probably the fingers. Unfortunately, finger strength is probably the most difficult to develop and keep. It is the first to go with increased age. There are exercises that I have used to develop my fingers. Fingertip chins on door jams, and ultimately one-arm chins on the first joint of the fingers. This tends to develop power more than stamina. And in most instances, a boulderer is concerned with a sudden burst of power, as opposed to long-term stamina. But not always. Now, the sort of strength one develops when working on the steel rings seems to carry over to climbing. It gives you a certain amount of poise under stress, on overhangs, for example. I was able to do butterfly mounts on the rings, moderately easily, and an iron cross, and I did an inverted cross on occasion. I'm never quite sure what kind of day I'm going to have. Sometimes when I hit it, as the expression goes, I do extremely well, and on other occasions I've been known to do very poorly on just mediocre rock. I like bouldering sessions where you can afford to laugh at yourself and laugh at each other. I'll have to admit that in some instances in the past 8 or 10 years, I felt a bit like the classical old Western gunfighter who's always being goaded into a shootout on Main Street. I'd rather go out with a friend, an acquaintance with whom I can relax a little, as opposed to someone to whom I must prove my absurdly impractical abilities all over again. And my climbing philosophy has more or less stabilized at this point in life. I enjoy very competitive bouldering on occasion, not always, and I get quite a bit of satisfaction out of reclimbing routes that I've established. And from time to time, I've been locked in the grips of a consuming passion for this route or that, but these have been periods of short duration. I don't hold a grudge against the nemesis. I've always enjoyed hiking. It has been an entirely separate activity for me within the mountain realm. When I go hiking, I usually don't even think about bouldering. I can walk beneath a beautiful boulder, and it will catch my eye for just a moment. I'd rather look at the flowers, the trees, and the birds. At the Hagermeister boulders, it must have been in the very early 1960s, I drove up for a session of bouldering, got out of the car, took my shoes and chalk, walked over to the standard slab route and sat down. And when I picked up my shoes to put them on, there was a $20 bill lying on the ground. So I put my street shoes back on, put the $20 bill in my pocket, took my shoes and chalk, went back to the car and drove to town. And that was probably the most enjoyable bouldering session I've ever had. Now, a good bouldering route is not one where the sequence of holds is perfectly obvious. It should be difficult to discover the correct sequence. It should be difficult to execute the sequence. I do mathematical research, and you might be surprised by the very close parallel that exists between the two pursuits, one apparently purely intellectual and the other apparently purely physical. In both instances, a person stands more or less at a frontier. It is enlightening to follow the proof of an established theorem, but far more satisfying to discover a new theorem. It is a creative enterprise, and I do not believe in painting a picture by numbers. One takes a blank canvas and does something original. In both bouldering and mathematics, you stand upon the threshold of something new, something that requires not only brute force, whether it be physical or intellectual force, but a certain insight, a certain quantum jump from point to point. Now, I don't mean making a physical jump, although sometimes that helps. Something is there that can be created, possibly if one uses insight, intuition, etc., in order to make this quantum jump. One discovers that the bouldering route can be accomplished not by looking at each minute hold foot by foot, but by looking at the overall route. One gets an instinctive feeling that it can be done. And then, afterwards, start looking closely for and at holds. You usually find that they are there. Now, in bouldering, you're concerned as much, if not more, with form, style, elegance, and route difficulty as you are with getting to the top. Now, there are all sorts of routes that don't end on the tops of boulders. Traverses, for example. There are exceptional climbs that go partway up a cliff, and then you run into a blank wall, jump off, and that's the end of the bouldering problem. I've spoken with mountaineers about this sort of thing. It's usually difficult for them to adjust to a feeling for the small when they've been so concerned with the large. Now, one little epigram that Chouinard once applied to bouldering was instant suffering. I'll agree. It's as if you take a lengthy climb and squeeze it down into one or two moves. And to compensate for this decreased length, you increase the difficulty. And perhaps, with an excellent mental attitude, you not only integrate your moves better, but this in turn induces a telekinesis to levitate you slightly, even if it is only taking off a few ounces. A few ounces can make a tremendous difference. And that's that for today's episode. Now, I hope you enjoyed this slightly different one and got some old school wisdom out of it. I hope that you also learned that John Gill, even though he was a legend and seems almost like a bouldering god, he was just a normal man who liked to walk in nature, hike in the mountains, and sometimes climb up a boulder. Now, if you'd like to learn more about John Gill's life, do check out the book John Gill, Master of Rock by Pat Ament. It was my main source for this episode, and next to John Gill's own website, johngill.net. Now, if you have any questions or suggestions, feel free to let me know at boldbouldering on Instagram. And I hope to see you next time, stronger and bolder.